Back together again, you and I, Thursday, April 28th, 2022, on Connecticut Today. I talked a little about what I see as the FDA's hypocrisy regarding the possible banning of flavored cigarettes and cigars as well. Southern Connecticut State University economics professor James Thorson discussed the latest U.S. GDP numbers. Republican State Rep. Greg Howard updated us on discussions over a new crime bill. I got to begin with this. Because this is one of those things that I understand the goal behind this, but it just this is one of those things that you look at and say, well, maybe it's easy, but it really isn't. And a lot of people out there still smoke, right? And I don't care what you smoke, whether it's marijuana, whether it's cigars, whether it's a pipe. You use a hookah pipe, whatever, cigarettes, whatever. I choose not to smoke now. Smoked a little bit 20, 30, 35, 40 years ago when it was chic to do it in my mind. Then I just stopped. I said, listen, this is too expensive. I remember my dad's hacker's cough when he got up in the morning. I tell you about that all the time. So I watch all this stuff from afar. Nobody I really know that close to me in my family or my personal or professional life smokes. And that's it. But I watch this stuff from afar because when you watch stuff like this, especially when it comes to smoking, you can see legitimate health concerns versus stuff that is posturing, is pandering here. The FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, now get this, if you are a smoker and you like menthol cigarettes, okay? Do you like menthol cigarettes? Are you a menthol smoker out there? Now, I know for you people that smoke, some people still smoke flavored tobacco. Some do, some don't, whatever. I get that. I understand that. But the FDA is proposing a ban on menthol cigarettes and flavored cigars after a debate over whether to prohibit them. What's the debate? Well, the debate is, and I didn't know this, I read about this first years ago, menthol cigarettes, at least from what the companies will admit to and what the research shows, and I didn't know this for years, menthol cigarettes are aimed at black smokers, African-American smokers, men and women who smoke who are black, African-American. You are targeted or marketed to or specifically aimed at by menthol cigarettes. Under the ruling, menthol would be prohibited as a characterizing flavor in cigarettes. Additionally, all characterizing flavors, with the exception of tobacco, would be banned in cigars. So you wouldn't even be able to have a flavored cigar, right? You go in the convenience stores, you see the, I don't know, whether you see those dark cigars, those small ones, the you see cherry flavored and grape or whatever. You see them at like almost every convenience store, bodega, gas station, whatever. The proposed ban stands to have an impact on the tobacco market as a whole. Menthol cigarettes make up, and I didn't realize this, menthol cigarettes make up 1/3 of the cigarette market in the U.S. How about that? Huh? So the ban stands to have a huge impact on the tobacco market. Now, this takes a weird twist here because a lot of civil rights folks, a lot of proponents of equal rights and civil rights in the African-American community are not happy with this. Because they say this could cause, now follow along here, follow this, they say this could cause more interactions with police. Because they're afraid of police seeing black smokers, African-American smokers. I'm not making this up, folks. This is real. And they're worried that, for example, police officers may say, hey, where did you get that? Now, there's two levels you could look at here. Now, number one, you know, interactions between African-Americans and police. Listen, we know the problems those have caused, again, mainly because there's been resistance to cops. But look, there are some jerk cops out, too, there. We all know that, right? And there was the choking of a African-American man in New York because he was selling loose cigarettes on the outside of a store, and it eventually led to a man's death. The ban's critics argue that it'll result in illegal selling of the cigarettes. That's right, selling Lucy's, what they call, you said, not L-U-C-Y-S, as in L-O-O-S-I-E-S. The critics say that it'll result in the selling of cigarettes stretching law enforcement thin. Various civil rights figures, including the Reverend Al Sharpton and attorney Benjamin Crump, have warned that it could result in negative interactions between police and the black community. Black and Hispanic smokers tend to prefer menthol cigarettes to other types. Ah, so there you go. There you go. So that's interesting. See, here's what I think. Here's what I think. And not that anybody cares, but I'll let you know anyway. I think it is patently unfair. I do. And I'm not saying this as a smoker. In fact, I've never smoked a lit cigarette in my life. Cigars, thin cigars, big cigars, some marijuana from time to time. Never tried a pipe. I was going to say, nah, it's too much work. Put the tobacco in and everything and clean it out. And the pipe cleaners, get out of here. Enough of that. But yeah, I think this is patently unfair. And I think it could cause problems here. But again, see, this is what the feds do, and this is what states do. Well, we're not going to ban vaping, but we're going to ban just flavored vapes. Or we're not going to ban cigarettes, but we're going to ban menthol cigarettes. So you don't think that's going to create a black market? Come on. Be serious. Come on. See, if the federal government or a state government had any guts, which they don't, which I don't think they should, let people smoke. If it kills them, it kills them. Fine with me. I don't care. Maybe fine's not the right word, but you know what I mean. Listen, on that stuff, I'm a civil libertarian, actually. I'm not left or right on that. If you do something that ends up in your death, listen, you made that decision. But yeah, I kind of do think this is patently unfair. What do you think? And if you are a smoker, I'd like to talk to you about that. Do you smoke menthol cigarettes? Now, maybe you like this idea. But there may be a time you go to your local, wherever you buy cigarettes in Connecticut here, in Fairfield County, New Haven County. You buy them from a gas station in Bridgeport, a convenience mart in Stratford, some little mom and pop shop in Fairfield or Westport. And maybe you're a menthol smoker and you like menthol. Maybe you're not African-American. Maybe you're a white smoker that likes menthol for whatever reason. Menthol cigarettes have been around, I know, for decades. Is that patently unfair? Or are you of the school that, listen, it's not good for you, it can kill you, and we're going to ban it, and we should ban it, and if you go to another form of tobacco, well, maybe you'll vape instead of do menthol cigarettes, and that's better. Or maybe you'll switch to another brand and smoke less. Well, maybe that's better. Okay. But our Facebook question of the day, by the way, which I did mount put, oddly enough, on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WICC600. Are you in favor of a federal proposal to end the sale of menthol cigarettes because they're marketed to African Americans? And frankly, I wouldn't blame an African-American smoker, a black American who pays his or her taxes, who works. I wouldn't blame them. Again, I'm not a smoker, but I wouldn't blame them if they said, hey, why are you getting rid of something that my segment of the market is unusually drawn to? Now, on the flip side, you have people that say, yeah, but the reason you're drawn to smoking is specifically because, you know, menthol flavored tobacco products are aimed at you and we're looking out for your health. 333-9422. Once again, 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. You go to a lot of news sites today, and flashing lights, red, little siren icons there. The GDP, the gross domestic product, falling 1.4% in the latest measure. Is this a big deal? Is it a big deal only to economists? Should regular folks around here care? We welcome back to answer that and more about this Professor James Thorson, who teaches economics at Southern Connecticut State University. Professor, hi, it's Paul again at WICC. How are you?
I'm doing very good, thank you.
Well, thanks, Professor. Appreciate it. So I go to a couple of sites here, and it's like, you know, it's red lettering, and oh, my God, this is unexpected. Okay, so 1.4% drop in the GDP. What does that mean?
Well, I mean, it means that, you know, there are a few issues in the economy. I mean, some parts of the report were very good. So, for example, consumer spending is holding up, and part of private investment is going up. There's one of the big things was inventories were a bit lower than normal, and that dragged things down a little bit. You know, we're spending a little bit less on things like gasoline because the price of gasoline has spiked. You know, and of course, you know, the biggest concern I see here is the inflation numbers. If you take out energy and food, which obviously energy prices have been off the charts. I don't have to, you don't need an economist to tell you mm-hmm. that. But, you know, taking that out, prices still went up 5%, which is, you know, higher than normal and still is a little bit high. So, you know, the idea that inflation is transitory is looking less and less likely like that's the case. So hopefully, you know, the Fed can get that under control.
Now, how, Professor, does any of this affect maybe the average person listening to us? Now, prices, you're right. It doesn't take an economics guru to understand that. But long term, does any of this in any way, shape or form affect retirement funds, stock portfolios? What about that?
Okay. You know, right now, you know, the data is too mixed to really make a good forecast one way or the other. I mean, obviously, you know, there's risk in the economy, and that we've had a lot of economic growth for a long time. You know, unemployment rates are relatively low, although the labor force has been increasing a little bit. But you know, after long periods of economic growth, there is some risk, and things like 401ks and stock prices are really affected by the growth of the economy. So there is, you know, some risk there. You know, I'm not forecasting, you know, disaster imminently, but you know, we're at the point of the economy where we really got to be looking at things, you know, much more carefully because we've had, you know, a lot of growth. You know, in some industries we have a lot of labor shortages, and that's when, you know, things start to get a little dicey in the economy.
Economics Professor James Thorson from Southern Connecticut State University. Professor, hang on. We'll be right back with you. More on this. First, traffic and weather together right here on WICC. From Southern Connecticut State University, we have him on from time to time to talk about the economy. Professor James Thorson continues with us. Wanted to have him on today because, you know, any place you go, I'm just looking at the Drudge report right now. It's in big red letters, GDP down 1.4%. So we'll get, again, the professor's interpretation on that. You know, Professor, you talked about in your first segment here this kind of cycle of inflation we're in, and I saw a figure the other day. It's going to cost, you know, the average American family like $1,500 or $2,000 more this year. You know, I'm going to ask you the crystal ball question here, but how long does this last? And everybody you ask on this seems to have a different answer. So, you know, what's your gaze on this whole thing?
Well, I mean, I think in the next year, I wouldn't be surprised if they get things under control. I mean, the Fed is, you know, watching this very carefully. They're raising interest rates. You know, they're doing the Fed right now is doing the things that they ought to be doing to try to bring this under control. So I, you know, inflation at this point is not at such a high rate that it's a real problem. And, you know, the Fed is acting, you know, I think appropriately, you know, and I think that, you know, one thing that, you know, was a little bit scary when the, you know, Ukraine invasion happened and oil prices spiked, you know, mm-hmm. the Fed could have been very tempted to, you know, forget about inflation. And that's where, you know, things can really spiral. So I think that the Fed has kept an even keel. So I would say in about a year or so, we should be closer to normal.
What happens if we're not in a year? What is the timeline, if there is one, where this goes from a problem to an even bigger problem? Or is there any way to have a grip on that?
I mean, the way we've historically in the United States, when we've had periods of high inflation, at least as long as the Fed is taking it seriously, it usually comes under control within a period of about 2 years. I mean, we did have some problems you know, in the 70s, and that was a combination of oil prices going up and, you know, Fed policy being a little bit too expansionary in the 1970s. But you know, I think that if inflation is higher than normal, I think it means that the Fed's going to have more drastic, you know, measures, and of course that could lead us into a recession. So I mean, this is, you know, the real question is partly a political one. You know, are our politicians going to be willing to, you know, let us be into a recession to get rid of the inflation? If they're not, then I think we could have inflation for a longer period of time, because you know if it's low, you can increase rates slowly, it'll slow the economy a little bit but not put us into a recession. If we go into a recession, that causes political problems, and you know, then politicians aren't always you know, doing the right things, or they're more worried about getting reelected.
You really, huh? Professor James Thorson, Southern Connecticut State University. Now, Professor, when we have times like this, whether it's inflation, deflation, whenever there's unrest in the economy, I always sit back and it impresses me, because not that the inflation impresses me, but it impresses me how complex the whole thing is, how, you know, this confluence of things, war, stocks, oil, interest rates, as robust as we think the American economy is, and it usually is, if one or two of these constant variables gets kind of out of whack, it's incredible how this can suddenly go from a ho-hum thing to an uh-oh situation.
Yes, no, we have an incredibly complex economy. You know, the good news about that is, you know, for example, we all have money in 401ks and that type of thing. So we're exposed to, you know, to the economy. And that's a good thing, you know, in the long run, because it makes us wealthier. But it also means that when things, you know, get bad, that means, you know, it's not so much fun looking at our 401k balances. So, yeah, I mean, everything is very much related. And as our economy becomes more advanced, there's more and more pieces, because we have much and much, you know, we have more and more specialization. So therefore, it really requires everything working together. So.
Professor James Thorson, thank you. We appreciate it. Good thoughts there. Southern Connecticut State University in the economics department there. Professor, good to speak with you again. Take care, and we'll chat down the line. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. All
appreciate right. it. Bye-bye. There you go. It's complicated, folks, isn't it? The economy just chugging away. Everything's great. The American dream. And then all of a sudden, you get a war. Not that a war is a little thing, right? You get a war. You get higher energy prices. There's this fascinating, delicate balance that cycles trillions and millions and trillions of dollars, right, every day. Then all of a sudden you hear it on the news, right, wherever you get your news, here or anywhere else. War, you know, war is going to rage, or, you know, here comes the price of oil. Oh, no, oil's above $75 a gallon, a barrel above $100 a barrel. And that's part two. And then part three comes in with, you know, short selling and trading of stocks. So it is, it's a complicated, we think it's simple, but it's complicated. And again, Professor Thorson saying there, what I've been hearing from other folks who I invite on this show to talk about economics, they're not talking about it in a term of months anymore. You notice that? They're saying, well, year, at the end of this year, or at the end of next year. And it's always kind, you know, when I hear guests all saying kind of the same thing, you know, part of me starts going, okay, year. And again, like he said, there's the political aspect of it as well, right? Right? And how much of what a government does or does not do is hooked in with the politics. Oh, I know. We've got traffic and weather together coming up. Listen, when we come back after the break, got a couple calls here. There's a couple of stories in the news that just, I don't know. You wonder what people are thinking, right? You work in some place, or your office, or in a social setting, or you know, somewhere else, and you say, geez, what was that person thinking? Now, you wonder if they weren't thinking at all, or you say to yourself, maybe they are thinking and they're pushing an agenda. An agenda being pushed? No, you're kidding. We like to keep our eyes and ears peeled on what's going on, or maybe what's not going on. In the General Assembly, big debate going on about a controversial, at least to some people, bill to tighten up things criminal justice-wise in the state, fix things that need to be fixed, to concentrate a bit more on youth, juveniles, early offenders, get them the help they need before they delve into a life of criminality. Joining us right now, gentlemen returning here, Republican State Rep. Greg Howard. He represents the 43rd General Assembly District. Greg is a Stonington police officer in outside the Capitol, and he's also the ranking member on the General Assembly's Public Safety Committee. Greg, it's Paul here again. Sir, how are you? Welcome back. How you doing?
Doing well, Paul. Good evening. Thanks for having me again. Great to talk to you.
Well, you know nobody better than you, I think, Greg, with your background and everything, to keep us updated on this. So where do we stand now, Greg? We know time is winding down here, and there's budget stuff and all this other stuff, but where do we stand on this bill, Greg, to, I guess, tighten some things up in juvenile justice and justice in general? You know, the news reports, Greg, were that there is agreement on some things here, but where are the sticking points still?
Well, I'm not sure that they're I think we're in a good spot. I think we stand in the on-deck circle, quite frankly. And I mean that because we're right now debating SB6, and we may very well be discussing the juvenile justice bill, which is HB 5417, next. So we literally may be in the on-deck circle. But as you know, Paul, things have a way of changing around here. But so the bill was a bipartisan agreement, and as with most negotiations and agreements, not everybody walked away all the way happy, but somewhat satisfied. But we did get, in my opinion, things that we've been asking for a while that I think will help provide a sense of accountability to some of our juvenile offenders, you know, more immediate after their first offense, or as we identify them as somebody who is at risk for heading down a life of crime, to try to curb that and get them on a better path much earlier. One of the more controversial aspects that was allowing the court to order electronic monitoring for child after they were charged with a second or subsequent motor vehicle property theft. Because that's really the underlying, crime that has been sort of at the forefront and the most dangerous thing. Because, you know, now we have potentially unlicensed young people who are engaging in reckless activity. Now they have, a 2,000-pound ballistic missile that we call a motor vehicle careening down our highways, and police officers try to stop them, and becoming quite a safety risk. So that's one of the things. And then relevant to motor vehicle larcenies, current state statute defines the degree of larceny for a motor vehicle based on the value.
Greg, I tell that to people because we've talked about this before, and they look at me like I have four eyes. And they say,
"Well, they won't do that anymore."
Well, good, because they say, "Wait a minute. So if my kid steals a $2,000 beater versus a $50,000 Mercedes, it's different?" I say, "Yeah, it is. It is."
Yeah, so we're going to bring that into a bit more of alignment. That's how most of our larceny statutes work. You know, so stealing a Snickers bar is a lot different than embezzling a few $100,000, right? So, when it comes to vehicles, this legislation seeks to step up the degree of crime based upon the subsequent offense. So, in other words, whether you steal a Mercedes or a 1975 Dodge Dart or something, which maybe is worth money now, I'm not sure. But either one, it's the same first offense. And then, that would be the legislation that was agreed upon was an A misdemeanor. We are working on potentially making that an E felony for the first offense. Mm-hmm. And that's, again, that you're getting this in such real time. That go to E felony, and then it'll step up from there. So then a second offense would be, a C felony, and then a B felony for a third offense, regardless of the value of the vehicle. So it sort of gets a higher degree as we understand that people who are, whether young people or otherwise, are engaging in this, that, we would try to continue to ramp up the enforcement to try to cut it off.
Yeah, and Greg, your life as a police officer full time, I mean, you probably see young folks out there. We've talked about this before, right? Your antenna goes up, Greg. You probably can see when you encounter juveniles, okay, this kid just made a mistake, but I think he or she is going to be okay. And then you probably see kids like, the This is not the first time, and we're getting near critical mass here. We're getting near the point of no return, unfortunately, right?
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. And, you know, there's a lot for every kid, you know, or every young person that involves themselves in this crime, their circumstances are different. And that's, you know, we've opened up a little bit more for the juvenile court process to take, you know, appropriate action, whereas prior to this legislation, as it says today, the juvenile court system is fairly well hamstrung until these people turn 18, these young people turn 18. So we've opened up a few more doors for them. And, you know, the bill also talks about, you know, pretrial diversionary programs, success rates for those, recidivism. And this is, you know, not just this, everything up here, Paul, I'm up in Hartford now, obviously, is, you know, these either or propositions. And oftentimes the answer is and, right? So we're talking about, you know, crime, you know, across the board, in this case, juvenile crime. And you have, you know, some group of people who say, well, we need to work on prevention. And other people say, no, we need to work on enforcement. Well, no, you need to do both.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, you know, to properly curb crime, the goal should be to prevent it. And if we can work on prevention, that we should. That's a noble thing. We should really work hard on it. And that's, you know, this bill seeks to do that. But it also confesses that despite those efforts, there will be folks at times, you know, young people or adults, where our efforts to prevent them from committing crime failed, and there has to be consequences for that. And that works to not only deter them from doing it, but to take others who in our continued effort to prevent crime to see that there are consequences. But, you know, I think to your earlier point, we have to give we have to break some cycles with some of these young people that are and give them some accountability that they need. And that's where the GPS monitoring comes in. It's not about you know, locking kids up, as you hear. It's about giving them that little voice in the back of their head that says, somebody is watching me. Somebody is paying attention to what I'm doing, and hopefully prevent them from, you know, taking those risky moves.
Greg, final question. You know, the time is getting short. Other bills still being considered. Do you think there's enough time to get this through the House, maybe, like you said, hopefully tonight or tomorrow, and then get it through the Senate where there are critics there? What do you think?
Yeah, no, I think it will. I think let's not forget that November is around the corner, you know, and we'd be foolish to pretend that politics didn't play a role in this. Look, Republicans have been asking for a lot of these initiatives for since I got here 18 months ago. We've asked for special sessions. We've asked for a lot of things. The governor has gone out and touted this bill. So I think that the majority party up in the Senate would be hard-pressed not to get this through. And, you know, to get it to his signature, which is ultimately what I think the governor wants at this point. So I do think that, you know, I applaud the efforts of the Republicans and you know, the Judiciary Committee ranking members for their continued efforts in pushing and pushing and pushing. And the public at large, I mean, the public has done a great job of making their voice heard, and good for them. God bless them for it. And I think it's despite some opposition, I think it will probably get out of the House today. And hopefully see the Senate early next week in time to get to the governor's desk and get some of these enacted and get these kids on a better path.
All right, we shall see. Greg, thank you. We'll be in touch next week. Thank you, sir.
Always a pleasure. Have a great day.
Appreciate it. State Rep. Greg Howard, 43rd General Assembly District, ranking member, public safety, and a police officer. See, lawmakers do have other lives. And who better to talk about? And there are some law enforcement folks in the General Assembly. We need more regular folks like Greg on both sides of the aisle who are legislating on things that they actually come in contact with, right? Folks, I think that's the perfect kind of legislator to have debating this bill. Somebody who is trying to draw up something, getting into the minutiae here, and then, you know, in another life or in the same life at other times is wearing a badge and a gun and has to encounter things that a bill or a piece of legislation is designed to battle.